Other questions?
Did we have a question on then 2.? Five? Did we have a question on 2.5?
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly what we did in class.
Okay, right? So that. Refresh myself on what we did in class here. That's.
I think we just want to know if our side was the right side.
This is what we did, I think.
Yeah, right there is where we're starting.
Okay, yep. And
that's,
we're just filling out to the end here and then trying to find what A is.
Yep, and that's like the first thing to do there.
Okay, and yeah, I probably can finish that out, maybe. I'd have to take a look at it first.
Other questions? So kind of the plan of chapter 2 is to go through a lot of examples with the idea that by seeing, as opposed to kind of just writing down what the general case is, the idea is that by going through these examples, you get a feeling, you get some examples for how the general case works. So the simplest case is the infinite square well, and in a while we'll do the finite square well. And the wave functions, if we choose 0 to L, are just sine functions, and it all works out pretty easy because the Hamiltonian, since it has no potential, is just the usual F double prime is minus F sort of format, and we can solve those things in general. If we look at the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, then we have to add in this exponential piece, and what we did last time was look at superpositions of those sort of functions. And what we saw is by making superpositions, we could make things that weren't standing, that didn't have a constant value for the value for the probability density. And instead, we could have the probability sloshing back and forth from one side. So if we just look at the properties of these functions, we're going to see these repeat. The ground state has no nodes and is even, and as we go down this list, they go even, odd, and we keep adding a node every time we go down in, I should say, up in energy. These things are just signs, and you learned in Fourier, and for that matter, E&M, that they're orthogonal, and we can normalize them so that we have that integral. And again, we need to learn to see this notation as the integral of, from, in this case, from 0 to L of psi n star psi m dx. From Fourier series, you know you can expand any function in terms of those signs, and those are the expansion coefficients, and we can use Fourier's trick in order to calculate those expansion coefficients. In E&M, those expansion coefficients kind of didn't have any particular meaning. They just, you know, were whatever they number we came up with. Here, I claim that we can think about the magnitude of Cn squared as being kind of like the probability that the particle is in the psi n state. Griffith doesn't like those words. He would prefer to say it's the probability that if you measured the energy of the particle, you would find En. If we have an initial value problem, so we specify what the wave function is at time equals zero and we want to find the future, it couldn't be easier. All we do is we tack on those exponentially varying forms, because we know that each one of these things satisfies the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, and so a superposition of them will satisfy the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. You might notice that these psi n's have been chosen to be real, but I claimed that quantum mechanics was fundamentally complex. It'll turn out that we can choose them to be real under lots of these sorts of circumstances, but do notice that if we choose this psi n to be real, very quickly in time, we're going to pick up some complex stuff. And along the way, we showed this relationship, which we're going to be using frequently. questions? Well, every physicist's favorite example is the simple harmonic oscillator. And with the simple harmonic oscillator, we know that the force, according to Hooke's law, is minus kx, or the potential energy is 1/2 kx squared. And we know that the oscillation frequency is the square root of k over m. So if we want, we can rewrite this as 1/2 m omega squared x squared. And just because omega is certainly more measurable quantum mechanically than the spring constant is. So that means that the Hamiltonian that we want to solve, minus h bar squared over 2m, two derivatives with respect to x of psi, plus the potential energy, 1/2 m omega squared x squared times psi, is supposed to be a constant, so-called eigenenergy times psi. Before we kind of tackle this, let's go back to kind of a physical mechanics point of view of the simple harmonic oscillator. So I've sketched out what the potential energy is as a function of position, and we know that the energy as a function of position has to be a constant. And of course we know that the potential energy plus the kinetic energy has to equal that energy. So the distance between the potential energy curve and the constant energy, that's the kinetic energy. So we can't have negative kinetic energy classically. So points like this are called turning points. One on the other side too, because that's where the velocity is goes to zero and it's going to flip from positive to negative or the other way around. So we're going to have standing waves between the turning points. That's kind of no surprise, things that look a lot like this. The one thing that's maybe a little bit of a surprise is we will be able to find the particle where it would have what you would call negative kinetic energy. It's not going to be particularly likely, but it's going to happen some. So if we look at the wave function beyond the turning point, it's going to be exponentially small. But it isn't going to be zero for x greater than that turning point. Between these turning points, we're going to have, you know, some sort of oscillation, not exactly sines and cosines, but some sort of oscillation. And they're going to be alternating even and odd. It's going to look much the same, except instead of having simple, real simple functions like sine and cosine, we're going to have slightly more complicated functions, which are called the Hermite polynomials. Okay, so that's kind of overall how this thing is going to look. The first thing to do to make this problem tractable is to get rid of as much of the complication as we can. And one of the freedoms we have, of course, and maybe this is simultaneously something that's desirable, is to choose a coordinate for the x value that makes things simple. So kind of my plan is, instead of expressing x in meters, I'm going to express it as a multiple of some new unit of length. And instead of writing the energy in terms of joules, I'm going to express it in terms of some unit of energy. So that E there isn't 2.7, it's just whatever the unit of energy is. So if we go to these sort of dimensionless quantities, we're going to get rid of all of these constants. And not only that, we have something that you can actually plot with Mathematica, right? Because the plot axes of Mathematica have to be normal numbers. Well, they don't have to be, but it's a lot nicer if they are normal numbers as opposed to numbers like, you know, 10 to the minus 9th meters. So how do we come up with these units of length and energy so that we can make this problem much more tractable. Well, what are the units of these quantities that are sitting here? And we kind of wish weren't there to make this equation not look like the differential equations that you had in diff EQ, right? Usually you had things that weren't this ugly. So this quantity here, you remember, is really just the spring constant. So the spring constant has units of force per length, which is the same thing as energy per length squared, right? Because energy is joule meters. What are the units of two derivatives with respect to x? Nope. There are no seconds in there at all, right? Well, so just one derivative of a function is that, and it's going to pull up units of inverse length, right? The electric field was the derivative of the voltage, and so we could measure electric field in volts per meter. So one over x squared. Right? And of course, all of this stuff together has to have the same units as energy for this equation to work out. So it must be that this constant here has to have the units of energy times length squared. And we could work that out if we wanted to from the units of h bar and m. So aside from this minus sign, instead of keeping writing these constants, let me call them a and b. And you can see that I could make a unit of energy by taking the square root of a times b, right? The l squares would cancel and I'd get an e squared, and I would then have something that has the units of energy. And I could make something that has the units of length by taking a and dividing it by b. That would give me l to the fourth, so I'd want the fourth root. Okay. So, I mean, those are kind of my choices. Will that actually help things? So if I write my energy as this dimensionless version of energy times my unit of energy, and if I write my x as my dimensionless value of x times this unit of length, and I similarly want to do this for the derivative, let's be a little bit careful about how we do this with respect to the derivative. So the derivative is that. And I guess we could do this in a fancier way. But x is equal to x prime times l. And l is a constant, so this is going to be 1 over l squared, two derivatives with respect to x prime squared. And think about it, it had to be something like that because this is clearly dimensionless and we knew that this had dimensions of 1 over length squared, so it better be working like that. So what I've got then here is, and I guess I can simplify my life, remember I called this quantity here b, so what I've got here is minus a and then I've got 1 over the length squared, so that's going to be b over a to the 1/2. And then two derivatives with respect to the prime coordinate squared. Okay, so it's kind of looking like a mess. Let's rewrite it. So we have that's our derivative term, and then we've got our b term, and that's got our this quantity squared in it. So that's going to be a over b to the 1/2. So all of that is what we're supposed to do on psi, and we're supposed to get our dimensionless version of energy times the square root of ab. And you can see that the square root of ab cancels out. So the differential equation we've got in the end sure looks a lot easier than the differential equation we had to start, just by choosing nice units for our basic variable. And so x and e are now dimensionless quantities, so we can add them up all that we want. Now there's yet another reason for, so doing this process, finding the appropriate units for your problem is pretty much required all the time in order to make things easy. And not only that, it's basically required. Because if we're going to have a solution that is, you know, some new function, it has to be a function of dimensionless variables, right? Sine, cosine, all the functions on your calculator only eat things that are dimensionless. So we need to have something that is dimensionless like x prime if we're going to have a nice solution. Okay, so going to dimensionless coordinates is pretty much the start of working any of these problems. It might be smart to write what this length scale was. So this length scale was a over b to the 1/4. And you remember that a was h bar squared divided by 2m, and b was 1/2 k, well, k was m omega squared, all of that to the 1/4. So what we've got here is what the 1/2s are going to cancel. So we have h bar squared divided by m squared omega squared to the 1/2. So this unit of length is h m omega h bar to the 1/2. I don't know, just to confirm that this actually does have the units of length, what are the units of h bar? Joule seconds. So there are kind of three things you should remember about h bar. One is that it's in the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And the Heisenberg uncertainty principle can be written as two different ways. One, position times momentum, or also energy times time. And also it turns out that h bar is going to be the unit of angular momentum. So, I don't know, this is the one that you guys said, that h bar had the units of energy times time. And we're supposed to divide that by mass per time. Right, because omega is a per time thing. So what we've got here is energy times time squared divided by mass. And you all know that one formula for energy is 1/2 mv squared, right? So the units of energy have to be mass times length per time squared. And so in fact, you can see we do get the units of length out. So the plan is to work these things always in dimensionless quantities, and if you want to actually get something out in meters in the end, you can just tack on this unit of length given the value of omega and h bar and m for your particular problem. Okay. So that's the first step we did. We found dimensionless coordinates. And with dimensionless coordinates, the differential equation looks about as simple as it's ever going to look. So the next step for solving these sorts of differential equations is to look at the extreme cases. Look at how the function has to behave as x goes to infinity. Now, sometimes the origin is singular, like if we were working the hydrogen atom, where the origin is an interesting place. Sometimes we'll also look at the behavior when something goes to zero. But the origin here isn't particularly special the way it is for the hydrogen atom. So we're just going to look at how things behave when x goes to infinity. So if we look at these results, and let me write it again as separate terms. Well, let me write it this way. So minus psi double prime plus x squared times psi has to equal e psi. What has to be the case when x goes to infinity? Well, this term is guaranteed to be way huger than that term, right? Because energy, whatever it is a constant, and x is going to go to infinity. So if this thing is going to work, this thing has to get as big as that so that they can cancel out. So when x goes to infinity, it must be that psi double prime is kind of like x squared times psi. And otherwise, there's no hope. So I'm not saying that it has to equal x squared times psi, but it has to be of that order of magnitude so we get a huge cancellation and we're left with something that's just of order of magnitude of the energy times psi. So what function has that behavior that when you take two derivatives of it, you get x squared times it? Yeah, it's probably not something you've thought about. What you have thought about, I'm sure, I hope, is if psi double prime is a constant, like k squared times psi, then you know that psi is going to be like e to the kx. Well, if we very naively and incorrectly think about x as being like a constant, does psi going like x squared work? Well, let's try it. Right? So if we take the first derivative of that function, we're going to bring down a 2x e to the x squared. And when we take the second derivative of that, we're going to get a derivative of that, but that's small change. We're going to end up getting that same thing squared. So it doesn't work, right? It gives us an extra factor of 4. But if you think about it, if we divide this by 2, then it's going to work. Okay, where the definition of work isn't equality, right? There are extra terms here, but this is the big term. Right? There would also be the term when we take the derivative of that, but that's of order of magnitude of the energy times psi, so we don't have to worry about it. Okay, so once you've figured out what the behavior is at the extreme, the plan is to factor it out. So we're going to say that psi is some new function, e to the minus x squared over 2. I guess I did that as positive, which would be bad, right, because it would explode, but exactly these same formulas would apply for e to the minus x squared over 2. So the extra 4 isn't there, right? The 4 would matter.
But if you're taking it to infinity, even if it was there, would it even matter?
Well, it would. So if we took derivatives here, then at large distances, what we would have is minus 4 x squared plus x squared times psi is equal to e psi. And they don't cancel, right? There's no hope that this thing could equal that. So we really need these things to approximately cancel so that we have a hope of getting something as small as just a constant times psi. So the first thing to comment is you can always do this, right? If whatever psi worked, you just divide it by this quantity and this equation would be true. So this is a without loss of generality. We can always write any function as being another function times e to the minus x squared over 2. Well, and I guess I should comment, right? At this point, I haven't bothered to put my x primes. All of these x's are dimensionless. So from now on, x is the dimensionless version of x, and e is the dimensionless version of the energy.
So here h is just like any function?
It's a function that we need to find. No, it's not the Hamiltonian. It'll be the Hermite polynomials. Okay, so factor out the behavior at x equals infinity. And what that means is that this thing here has a chance to be something that is normal, right? Like a polynomial. And now rewrite the differential equation. Okay, so again, the differential equation was minus psi double prime plus x squared psi, wanted to be a constant times psi. And now we're saying psi is a function h times e to the minus x squared over 2. So psi prime is equal to, well, the derivative could hit the h, or it could hit this term here. And we know that what that's going to do is bring down an x. And then we've got psi double prime. So the derivative could hit this, so we'd get h double prime. It could hit that. I might as well write it, I guess. So that's going to bring down an x. Not nearly done yet. It could hit this one here, that x. It could hit that h. Or finally, it could hit that this exponential term, and so we'd get plus x squared h e to the minus x squared over 2. Okay, so it's hard to see that this is making things simple. And I'm not sure I'll ever convince you of that, but I do have a very slight simplification, right? Those are the same term. These terms are very similar, but I'm going to leave them separate for the time being. So what I have here is h double prime minus 2xh prime minus h plus x squared times h all times e to the minus x squared over 2. And if I plug that in now in our original differential equation, I have minus h double prime minus 2xh prime minus h plus x squared h all times e to the minus x squared over 2 plus x squared h e to the minus x squared over 2, that psi, that wants to equal a constant times psi. So this is a lot of work, and the only thing we've gained from this is that those two terms now cancel. Right, that's the term that was getting huge as x goes to infinity, and now I've killed that term. There's also an overall factor of e to the minus x squared over 2, which I can kill. So what I've got then is minus h double prime plus 2x h prime plus h wants to equal a constant times h. Well, is this differential equation any better than the previous differential equation? It It's hard for me to tell you that one is better than the other just by looking at it, but you know, because I've spent time doing this, this one must be nicer. So the next step in this process is to try and find a solution for H that is a polynomial. From Taylor series expansion, you know that any function basically can be written as a Taylor series expansion. So by plugging in H as a power series, I should be able to get anything to work. So I'm going to say, let's let H be the sum of some constants and some powers of X. So why not do this right from the start? Why not say that psi is a polynomial? Well, the one thing you know for sure is that that polynomial couldn't converge, right? Because polynomials don't go to zero at infinity. They go to it plus or minus infinity at infinity. So there was no hope of that working. Now there is a hope of this working. This polynomial will go to infinity, but it's being multiplied by something that's small, which is going to kill it. So the wave function still could be normalizable. And of course, I wouldn't be doing this if it didn't work. Okay. So if that's what H is, what's the derivative of it? Well, it's going to bring down a k, ak, x to the k minus 1. And if I multiply that by minus 2x, or by plus 2x, it's going to bring that back up to just k. So h double prime is going to be the sum of k, k minus 1, ak, x to the k minus 2. Now, I would have thought you would have done this in differential equations, but you've probably forgotten it, huh? So now kind of the trick, we would like to see this sum combine with that sum, but they have different starting places. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to call k minus 2, let me just call that L. So what I've got here then is L plus 2 to give me k times L plus 1, and then I've got a L plus 2. That's certainly legit. And now what I'm going to do is call LK again. Right? Why not? I'm allowed to do that. Okay, so let's see what this has gotten us. So I've got this term here, which is minus the sum of k plus 2, k plus 1, ak plus 2, x to the k, right? After I do this kind of funny thing of shifting my k's basically by 2, I got this term here, which is right there. So this is the sum of 2k ak x to the k. And let me bring this to this side of the equation because they're basically the same. So this is going to be 1 minus e times the sum of ak x to the k. All of that has to equal 0. And the main point of shifting these polynomials now is I can put these things all together, right? So this is the sum of minus k plus 2 times k plus 1 times ak plus 2 plus 2k ak plus 1 minus e ak, all of this times x to the k. It's supposed to equal 0. So the only way that could equal 0 is if the coefficient of every value of x is 0. OK? Okay, well, what does that get us? Well, so what that means, if we put this AK to the other side of the equation, is we have then that 2K plus 1 minus E, all of that times AK, divided by K plus 2 times K plus 1, that has to equal K plus 2. Okay, so maybe that went fast. I put this term to the other side of the equation and I divided it through. And here I had these common terms which I factored. So this is called a two-term recursion relationship. So if I tell you what A0 is, I can calculate what A2 is and what A4 is and what A6 is, all the way up to infinity. And I can tell you, if this term actually goes to infinity, I'm not going to be happy. Because roughly speaking, it'll go then like e to the plus x squared, if I sum all of those terms, if they actually go to infinity. And that, combined with this, gives me something that's not normalizable. So I have to hope that this term truncates. So let's hope that I can find a solution where the last term is x to the n. And from there on out, I get zeros. Well, the only way that could be the case is if this term is zero, and so the next one is zero from there on up. Right? Once one of those goes to zero, they're zero forever on, because they're just multiples of each other. Okay, so that means that 2n plus 1 minus e better equal 0, or this entropy better be of that form. Now that only works once. So if n were, for example, 9, if I know what's required to kill the 11th term, I can work my way backwards or forwards, and I can figure out what A1 is. But A0 better have been 0, or else it would have gone past to A12, right? Because the even and odd sequences are totally separated by this equation. So, if n is even, I'm going to start with a zero, and then I'm going to quit when this formula tells me to quit. If n is odd, then and this means that a1 is equal to zero. If a1 is odd, I'm going to start with a1 and assume that all the even terms are zero. Okay, and that means then that the overall function is going to be even or odd, because it doesn't mix even and odd powers of x. And of course, this term by itself is even. Okay, so let's kind of see how that works. Let's take the final term to be 4. Which of course means that the final energy is going to be 9, right? 2n plus 1. And let's work our way through. So let's start with A0 being 1, and let's calculate what A2 is. So according to this equation, what we have then for A2, put in K equals 0. So what we've got is 1 minus 9. Times A0 divided by 2. And of course, 1 minus 9 is 8, so this is minus 4. Once we've got A2, we can calculate A4. So if I plug in that A2 is minus 4, then what I'm going to have here, and K is 2, so I'm going to have here 2 times 2 is 4. plus this quantity is still minus 8. And then we're supposed to divide by 4 times 3. So what we've got is A4 is minus 4 times minus 4 divided by 4 times 3, which is 4/3. And we made it work out so that A6 is equal to 0 and A8 is equal to 0, etc. So a perfectly good solution is going to use H being 1 minus 4x squared plus 4/3 x to the 4th. Okay, so people have done this and they've written down all of these solutions, which are called the Hermite polynomials. And Mathematica knows about all of them, and our book has a nice table of, I don't know, a few of them. And we'll see if you feel cheated when I write down what H4 is. So it's on page 56. And it says that H4 is equal to 16, and I'll write it in, they use these funny terms zeta for their dimensionless version of x. So they have 16x to the 4th minus 48x squared plus 12. Okay, so that's the official version of it. We just have a multiple of it, right? If I take what I calculated and multiply it by 12, I get the value that's in the book. And the normalization of these wave function is kind of up for grabs, right? You can always multiply these solutions by a constant and still have a perfectly good solution. Well, so the same thing was true of the Legendre polynomials that we had last year. That they had particular formulas. And why they had that particular formula as opposed to twice that formula or half that formula, they both satisfied the differential equation because it was linear. And maybe 30% of this has to do with history. Kind of just who does it first, but 70% has to do with it that there are various formulas that look better when you choose particular normalizations. So currently we don't have any reason to prefer one of these over the other, but other formulas, this looks nicer if we use the book's formula. And that's the official formula. Even if it didn't look better one way or the other, it would be super nice if there was only one definition of this function so that everyone agreed to it. So the Hermite polynomials are, everyone in the world agrees, are the ones that are in the book. Okay, so let's kind of write down what we found. We have found a solution, let me call it Psi 4, in which the solution was, and I'll write it in terms of my polynomial, 1 minus 4 x squared plus 4/3 x to the 4th times e to the minus x squared over 2. And of course we need to normalize these wave functions by multiplying them by some overall constant. And I don't know if it's in, yeah, the book has it too, yes, no. The exact normalization constant is on the web page. I don't know if I bothered to write it down. It has an n factorial in it and a 2 to the power and looks kind of like a mess. But it's a known quantity. Okay, so I don't know, these dimensionless coordinates are great because we can plot that function. We don't have to put in the value of h bar or anything like that. But it is nice to kind of bring back the dimensional quantities So we have found the dimensionless energy was equal to 2 times an integer plus 1. And this integer, we could have stopped at the 0 term, we could have stopped at the first term, etc. This integer, you know, is anything starting at 0. And if we bring back our unit of energy, it turns out it's h bar omega over 2. So another way of writing this, more common way of writing this, would be n plus a half h bar omega. And if we really wanted to, I can't see that you would ever want to do this, but you could, of course, bring back the thing that is labeled here as x is, remember, the actual value of x divided by that funny unit of length, which was the, something like the fourth root of a over b. I'm not trying to write it out, but if you really wanted to write this in terms of dimensioned quantities, you could, but you'd be sorry you did it. Having the energy in normal units is not unhelpful.
So this whole thing is describing the energy given x?
So the energy given x doesn't sound good, because the energy should be a constant, right?
So this whole thing is describing the energy of an infinite square well?
So, and we're not talking about a square well, we're talking about a simple harmonic oscillator.
Oh, yeah.
So the overall game that we're after is to find probability densities. And the claim was that the standing wave probability densities are, in some sense, fundamental because you could expand anything in terms of them. So what we have found is the standing wave size. And if we squared those, we'd get probability densities for how, say, an electron could be in a simple harmonic oscillator state.
We just chose to find psi 4, is that right?
We just chose to find psi. We want to find all of them, right? We want to find them for all n. Yep. So that's the solution for any value. And as I say, you can look up in the book for a few values of the Hermite polynomial, but Mathematica knows them all. So we can plot them up. We could do anything we wanted to them.
So a simple harmonic oscillator in this quantum sense could be something like just an electron experiencing a restoring force?
Yes. Yep. So kind of the standard real example of this is molecular vibrations, right? So a normal chemical bond you could model as a spring, and so this thing is going to oscillate. And if it oscillates a lot, then we're in a big quantum state, right? So if we were to plot up these wave functions, So here is psi being plotted as a function of x. When n equals 0, that h is just a constant. So this is just this kind of Gaussian term. So that's kind of what the wave function would look like. Right? So you remember that for the particle in a box, that's what we got. For n equals 1, this Hermite polynomial is just x. And so what we're going to get is a function that looks kind of like that. Right? And again, for the standing wave, we had something that looked like that. As we go higher and higher in energy, you know, these things are going to get further and further from the origin, and we'll get wave functions that look, they should be symmetrical. I'm sure I didn't succeed, but it's going to look kind of like that, right? Whereas the corresponding thing here, you know, would be lots of oscillations. Here the thing has to expand because the turning points for higher energy are further out. Here it can't expand because we have these impenetrable walls that are at 0 and L.
So why would there be a higher probability that it would be away from the center? Is that just because of the turning point? The fact that it would kind of,
Yeah, essentially. So it's basically totally a classical result. So if we just talk about a classical harmonic oscillator that we don't know anything about it, what's the probability of finding it near the turning points? Well, but what is it precisely? Yeah. So the probability of being in an interval, I claim, is proportional to how much time it would spend in that interval. If it spends a lot of time in an interval, then we're likely to find it there. And so what is the little bit of time that it spends in some interval dx? Well, it's the velocity. And the velocity goes to zero at the turning points. So classically, if we were to plot the probability density, so here is the quadratic, here's the energy, so here are the turning points. So classically, the probability density goes to infinity at those turning points. And it turns out if we figure out what this is and plot it up, it looks pretty much like that. That is to say, it has waves in it, but on average, it hits the 1 over the velocity function. Classically, it's impossible for it to be here, and quantum mechanically, it is slightly possible to be there. It's just exponentially small. Okay, so the difference between classical mechanics and this is the presence of waves. Well, everything's a wave. That's kind of no surprise. And the presence of the particle where it's Newtonianly, mechanically impossible for it to be. It's not highly likely to be there, but it can be there.
So n equals zero means that it kind of has no energy, right? Or like no initial energy?
So it has the smallest possible energy, right? So the energy is n plus a half times h bar omega. So if n equals zero, we have the smallest possible energy. And classically, there's no reason you can't have zero energy. But if you had zero energy, you'd have exactly zero velocity, and you'd be not satisfying Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So there's always what's called zero point energy. That is to say, energy even when there isn't any motion, minimum amount of motion. Let me say a couple of more things that just have to do with this problem. If I plot these wave functions, it kind of starts to look like a mess pretty fast. So the solution can be confusing. So what people do to plot these wave functions is they choose different axes. They choose an axis for n equals 1, n equals 0. They choose a different axis for n equals 1 and a different axis for n equals 2. And they choose those axes so that where the energy hits the potential energy curve, that's the turning point. And since they have different energies, they're not going to be plotted on top of each other. Okay, but do recognize, so this n equals 2 is going to be an even function with two nodes? Yeah, so I guess it looks kind of like that. So do recognize that if you see those sorts of plots, this is what psi is, right? So this wave function isn't in any sense any bigger than this wave function, which would look kind of like that. It's just been shifted up so that we can see what it looks like without covering everything up. So the plan is to push things up push them up in a proportion to the energy of the corresponding wave function. Right, so this is the ground state. This guy here would have one node, it would look kind of like that. Okay, good to go. So again, if you follow the book, we're going to find a faster way to work these problems called the operator methods, and it does that first. But I like to do it this way first.